From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoen with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is away at a conference. On today's Fresh Air, Patty Davis, the daughter of Ronald and Nancy Reagan. She says her parents sent a message of traditional family values to the public, but in their own house, they didn't practice them. Coming up, a look inside life with the Reagans. The worst is over in Los Angeles, and now South Central residents have little left but rubble and charred buildings. Coming up, we'll talk with Sweet Alice Harris, who lives in Watts. She started and runs Parents of Watts, working with youth and adults. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a box set of vintage Howling Wolf blues. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In the aftermath of the riots in Los Angeles, the Bush administration is blaming the social welfare programs of the 60s and 70s for the conditions leading to last week's disturbances. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the root causes of the riots are traceable to the breakdown of the family and the community, which he said are attributable to liberal schemes of the 60s and 70s to redistribute wealth and provide handouts to the poor. But when pressed, Fitzwater declined to identify any single social program that he claimed had failed. Earlier today, President Bush pointed the finger of blame towards Congress, which he accused of neglecting his domestic agenda.
We have some very good ideas that we have out there that would have been extraordinarily helpful if they'd been put into effect. We think home ownership is a very good concept, and we've been fighting for it for a long time.
Mr. Bush is sending a delegation headed by Deputy Education Secretary David Kearns to report back on the situation in Los Angeles. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
California officials say the Los Angeles riots are likely to cost the state huge losses in property taxes and a greater demand for social services. Direct costs to the states included about $2 million in damage to 17 government buildings and an undetermined share of the $5 million a day bill for police and emergency services. Today, a state senator proposed increasing the state sales tax by 0.25 cent for a year to raise $750 million to help the victims of the rioting and the recent earthquakes. Iraq asked the UN Security Council today to call an urgent meeting to discuss the riots in Los Angeles and other American cities. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations.
Baghdad has sent a letter to the Austrian president of the Security Council asking the council to consider the situation in Los Angeles and other American cities and the suffering of civilians in these areas. The letter urges the passage of a resolution that would be in line with previous UN decisions on human rights violations. Iraq says the U.S. is violating human rights and accuses the U.S. of segregation and of applying its laws unfairly. While the request is expected to be brought up at a closed-door meeting Tuesday, diplomats predict with confidence that no action is likely to take place. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
A federal judge ruled today that a Justice Department investigator is entitled to examine extensive records from the scandal-ridden House Bank. In doing so, Judge John Garrett Penn denied a motion filed by two Congress members, which sought to block the subpoena on the ground that it violated the privacy of Congress members who didn't write bad checks. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 42 points to close at 3,378. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 2-1. This is NPR. The president of Bosnia said today that he'll ask for outside military help to drive the Yugoslav Federal Army from Bosnian territory. Sarajevo television said that President Alija Izetbegović will appeal for help from the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. The appeal came as ethnic Serbs backed by the Federal Army shelled Sarajevo from positions outside the capital. The two sides tried to defuse tensions today as UN monitors helped return 150 Yugoslav soldiers who were captured by Bosnian defense forces. A closely divided Supreme Court ruled today that the federal courts may not dismiss a grand jury indictment upon learning that government prosecutors intentionally withheld from the grand jury substantial evidence in their possession that could release a defendant from suspicion. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
John Williams was indicted on 7 counts of making false financial statements to a federally insured bank. but two federal courts threw out the indictment because federal prosecutors had knowingly withheld information suggesting that Williams did not file false statements. Today, however, the Supreme Court reinstated the indictment by a 5-4 vote. Writing for the court majority, Justice Antonin Scalia said the federal courts have no inherent authority to formulate procedural rules for fairness in a grand jury proceeding. The historic role of the grand jury, he said, is accusatory, not adversarial. The four dissenters, led by Justice John Paul Stevens, said it blinks reality and undermines the fundamental fairness of the courts to allow a prosecutor to knowingly mislead a grand jury by withholding exculpatory facts in his possession. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev visited today with former President Ronald Reagan in California. Gorbachev received the first Ronald Reagan Freedom Award at the Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Patty Davis was a child of the 60s, you know, an anti-war, anti-nuclear activist who hung out with rock stars, married a yoga instructor, and supported a woman's right to an abortion. Davis was also a child of Ronald and Nancy Reagan, and her leftist political views took on an added meaning. This rift in the Reagan family was well known, but in the mid-80s, with her father still in the White House, Davis became even more outspoken. She began writing novels. The first, Homefront, has a plot that may sound familiar. The central character, Beth Canfield, undergoes a personal crisis when her leftist political views become an issue in her conservative father's campaign for the presidency. Davis' second novel, A House of Secrets, tells the story of a young woman whose mother compulsively and violently tries to control every aspect of her life. Davis has now come out from behind her thin veil of fiction and written a memoir called The Way I See It. Terry Gross spoke with Patty Davis last week.
Now, you write that you've learned forgiveness and gotten over some of your anger.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you write the book?
Well, to say that, basically, and to say that whatever somebody's experiences were in their childhood, there is a way of looking at them differently. And there is a way of coming to the realization that your parents did the best they knew how. I don't think this is information that we should sit on. If any of us come to this point, do the work in our lives to come to this point, I think we have a responsibility to share it with each other in whatever way is appropriate to our lives, and writing a book is appropriate to mine. I'm a public person and I'm a writer.
How did it make you feel to think that your family, which you think of as a dysfunctional family, was the first family in the pro-family White House?
You know, actually, I thought it was kind of appropriate in a way, because we're dysfunctional as a country. I mean, first of all, I think most families are dysfunctional to one degree or another. That's the work that we have to do as human beings on this planet. But we're a dysfunctional country. It's not surprising. And I think that we have to feel entitled to talk about that and deal with it and accept that about ourselves in order to change that about ourselves.
Well, one of the issues that you bring up in your memoir is that you felt that you felt that your parents' relationship with each other cut you off, that they were so involved with each other that there wasn't much room for you.
Well, that's true. It wasn't just me. I think it's anybody, really. We sort of saw that in this country, didn't we? I mean, their love is, I think I described it in the book, as being sort of two halves of a circle. And together they form this complete whole, and everybody else seems sort of superfluous to that. And certainly as a child growing up in that environment, I was aware of that, as were all their children.
What's an example of how you felt that there was no room for you?
Well, I think probably one of the most telling examples is a story I tell in the book about flying back after my father was shot. And it was Michael and Maureen and me on this Army transport plane. And I had this awareness that we were all conscious of the fact that we weren't really needed there. My parents needed each other. I mean, we were going back there and we wanted to be there, but we weren't really needed
How long did you stay?
I stayed a few days, I think.
Did you feel differently once you got there?
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't particularly feel different about that. But I did. I had an experience with my mother the morning after I... the morning that I arrived like before dawn or something like that. And I went into her bedroom and she told me that she told me that my father had almost died, and she told me that she had taken one of his shirts and had slept with it all night. And I was sitting on the bed, and it was the first time that I felt what forgiving her would feel like, because in that moment we were not a mother and daughter who had been at each other for years. We were just two people who had realized in a very short period of time how frightening life can get. And it was a very exquisite moment, which is why I sort of flash-forwarded and I began the book with that.
Mm-hmm. You write in your memoir, as uncomfortable as it is to talk about and write about, abuse is part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
How did your mother abuse you?
Physically, in terms of hitting me in the face, and emotionally, I think in ways of humiliation and making me feel that I could never measure up. But you know, I see it now as two people being abused there, because she was abusing herself too by doing that to me. I mean, our children are extensions of ourselves, and what we do to them, we on some level do to ourselves.
When you say she had hit you in the face, was that when you were misbehaving?
Oh, sometimes, and it almost became a ritual between us. It almost became this very predictable thing. It became a daily event after a while. But again, you know, you have to call it what it is, and it's abuse. And this is not a book about comparing war wounds. I don't tell these stories in a context of saying, let me tell you how horrible this was. You know, I'm not there anymore with a measuring stick on my childhood and saying, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how horrible is this? I don't think like that anymore. I did for a long time. What happened, happened, and you have to call it what it is. But also what was happening was something under the surface that on one level had nothing to do with me. These cycles started before I was born. They went back generations. I mean, I was a victim, my parents were victims, and my parents were victims of victims and on back. And I think that's where forgiveness comes in.
Are you on speaking terms with your parents now? I know there have been times when you haven't been.
And I'm not now. I haven't, we haven't spoken in quite a while.
Years, months?
The last time I saw my mother was in 1989. The last time I saw my father was in last year, as I was writing this book, and I went to see him. I wrote about that, a visit in his office, where I went to say to him, my purpose in writing this book is because I believe that the right way to live is just to tell the truth. Whatever that truth is, just tell it. It's okay. I'm not doing this to inflict pain. I knew he wouldn't hear that, and I knew he wouldn't accept that, but I felt that it was important to say it.
Yeah, here's what I wonder about that. I mean, I believe in telling the truth, but I also believe, you know, that you don't necessarily tell everything. I mean, you don't lie, but on the other hand, I mean, I don't tell everything I know about my parents or the people who are closest to me in my life. Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
That
just for reasons of privacy.
Well, I mean, there are certain things I didn't tell in this book, things that I didn't think were relevant. But the bigger issues and the stories that I chose that had a particular point to them,
yeah,
the point that I was trying to make, I felt were important to tell. Because, you know, to the degree that any of us feel that we have to hide, then we get caught up in feeling guilty and feeling ashamed. And that's a harsh way to live. And I know, because I lived like that for a long time.
So how come you haven't spoken to your mother since 89 and to your father since, I forget how long it was that you just
last year.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what this family is going to end up being. I don't even know what's supposed to happen. I do know that I couldn't have come to a place of releasing them from blame, and I couldn't have come to a place of forgiving them without pulling back and staying away. I needed that vantage point in order to change my perspective. And I think it would be wonderful to be able to stand in front of my parents and say to them, you know, I forgive you and I release you and all that. It's always a loaded situation, though, because any one of a number of things can come back at you, including, well, that's fine, you forgive us, but we don't necessarily forgive you, and then you have to forgive them for not forgiving you. That takes growth. I'm not sure I'm there yet, actually. I think there's still some fear there on my part. I think that coming to terms with your parental issues is internal work. You have to get clear about it within yourself. And then if something changes externally, great.
The last time you spoke to your mother was in 1989. That's the same year that her memoir, My Turn, was published.
Yes.
Are the two related?
No, I saw her before that, actually, before that book came out. I have not seen her after that.
But, I mean, was the book one of the reasons why you haven't been speaking with her?
Oh, no. Nothing in her books surprised me. I mean, I know there was a lot of attention on the 10 pages that she wrote about me and complaining about my infancy and all that. But nothing really surprised me.
Let me quote a couple of things that she says about you and get your side of it.
Okay.
She says, I've had my ups and downs with all four children, but my relationship with Patty has been one of the most painful and disappointing aspects of my life. I was a nervous mother, and Patty was a difficult baby from the start. She'd scream for hours. And then Nancy Reagan goes on to say that she thinks that she and Ronald Reagan were too indulgent and gave in to you too often. They paid you too much attention.
Well, I think that my response to that is that that's what she needs to believe. And that's okay. I understand that. That's, you know, we are talking about a family that has an enormous capacity for denial. And you just read part of it. And it's okay, you know. It's all right with me that she feels that way because that's what she needs to think. It's not my perspective on what happened, but it's all right.
Your mother was pregnant with you 2 months before she married your father.
Yes.
When did you find out about that?
Well, I figured it out one day when I was, I don't know, maybe I was 9 or 10, something like that. And I was snooping around through her desk drawers, and I found one of those little baby books that they give women, you know, with all the, you know, birth records and all that stuff. And I found my birth weight, which was almost 8 pounds. It's rather large, preemie. So I figured out that I probably wasn't premature, and I had been told that I'd been kept in an incubator and all of that stuff, and I was pretty sure they didn't make incubators that big. And but my mother never really admitted it. My mother never admitted it until she wrote her own book, and then she still didn't really admit it. I mean, she was a bit coy about it.
So did you kind of confronted your mother with this, didn't you?
Well, I don't know. I can't remember confronting her with that. You know, the other story that I'd been handed about my birth was that I had hung on to her ribs. And this was a story my parents gave me for years. And I think around that same time I was taking science class or something. And remember those color plates in the science books of the bodies that are cut in, had drawings of the bodies, you know, they're cut in half. So the female color plate. I thought, well, now here's the uterus. Baby's in the uterus. I sort of mapped it out, you know, what I would have had to do to hang onto her ribs, which basically meant punching through the uterus, snaking up through the intestines and shoving a few organs out of the way and grabbing onto her ribs. And so I came back with this book and I said, look, see, I couldn't have done this. And she said, well, you did. And you came out with scabs on your fingers. And the story got even more elaborate. So I didn't really confront it after that.
Was this something that you think you were made to feel guilty about when you were growing up, that you caused your mother such pain when you were being born?
I think that was probably part of it, yes. And I think also, That my parents felt compelled to lie that about my mother being pregnant when she got married because of the morality of the times. And being creative people, they just concocted this story. I think it's on the one hand that sort of simple, and then on the other hand more complex in terms of instilling guilt in me.
Terry Gross is speaking with Patty Davis, whose new memoir is called The Way I See It. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Patty Davis is my guest, and she's written an autobiography called The Way I See It, which is in part about growing up in the Reagan household. When your father became governor of California, what were you expected to do to help create the family image?
Well, I went to the inauguration, had the photographs taken, you know, at Christmas and all of that. That was basically it. I think that... I was not a desirable person to have around in too many of those occasions because I looked as miserable as I felt. And the pictures that are in this book of those occasions sort of bear me out on that. I was not a happy girl in those pictures.
What was the inaugural ball like for you?
Oh, God. It was horrible. It was horrible. They sit you up on this platform, this tiny little platform, and there's this crush of people there that are just standing there staring at you. It was like some Fellini movie. It was the most bizarre experience that I think I've ever been through. I mean, you don't know what to do. You're like just this little animal on exhibit or something. It was very strange.
How did you decide what to wear?
Someone told me what to wear. I was numb at that time. I had somebody had taken me on as a manager, and so he basically told me what to wear. And I was just, you know, I hadn't dealt with the enormity of the fact that my father was going to be president. I have done my time with denial, too. And my form of denial is getting real tough and saying, oh, it's okay, I can take it. This is fine. This is nothing. And I remember a friend saying to me, don't do that. This is big. Just recognize how big this is, you know. You're going to have to deal with this. And I didn't want to. So consequently, around that time, I was just sort of numb. And somebody told me to do something. I went, okay, wear this dress. Okay. It was a very odd time.
Who was your escort, as I think we call it?
Neil Leonard. He was a childhood friend. He'd gone to school with my brother. And he went with me.
How did you choose him? I mean, this must be really difficult. If you're not actually involved in a long-term relationship with someone, it must be a difficult
decision. My mother chose
him. Your mother chose him?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, I mean, why'd you let her choose someone, and why did she choose him?
Well, because I was in that numb phase.
Right.
Whatever, I don't care. And she said, he's going to... What was I going to take one of my friends? They'd show up in earrings and black leather. I mean, come on. I think she chose him because it's like God knows who Patty would bring to this, you know, some biker or something, you know. So I just went, okay, it's fine.
Your mother's big campaign when the Reagans were in the White House was the Just Say No campaign.
Yes.
But you write that she had a long history of tranquilizers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think of her as an abuser?
Well, I certainly saw a dependence there. And, you know, I agonized a lot over revealing this. But she's gotten a pretty heavy indictment from people who think that her choice of this issue was hypocritical, that she doesn't know anything about it, she doesn't care about it, it was a PR stunt. And then when she abandoned Phoenix House, she got even stiffer indictment. And, I mean, in some ways, she's been made a joke of. Comedians make jokes of her. I kept coming back to the same point, which was that I only ever saw it one way. I saw her choice of that issue as as I wrote in this book, both an act of denial and a cry for help. It was the only issue she could have chosen. She cares deeply for this issue, and she understands it more than people think. She has been, in my opinion, a victim of the medical establishment, and I felt, well, if all I can feel about this is compassion and sympathy, then if other people really knew the truth, they would feel the same thing. Because the indictment of hypocrisy has already been handed down. That's a done deal. If anything, this information will undo that and make people say, wow, that's what was going on there. There was a problem there that she was trying to deal with but then afraid to deal with, and all of that stuff was going on there. That kind of battle was going on within her.
Do you think she still is dependent on tranquilizers?
I don't know, but they are very, very difficult to get off of. I mean, you pretty much have to, you have to go for treatment.
So you think she was still dependent when she was in the White House?
Well, I know in 81 she was. I told a story about when my grandfather was dying, where I saw her get a prescription from his doctor. So I know in 81 she was. You know, I think there's a point here I want to make. I think that if my mother realized that by talking about her own reality and her own situation, people would not condemn her. They would, in fact, flock to her. She could have as much effect on the anti-drug issue as Magic Johnson has had on AIDS awareness, because the truth of the matter is we're a drug-taking society on every level, from prescription drugs from doctors to over-the-counter medications to street drugs. It permeates the society. And until we realize that about ourselves, we're always going to have a drug problem in this society. And I think that my mother, perhaps more than anyone else, could bring awareness to that and could have a tremendous effect.
We should mention here, you've had problems with drugs yourself.
I was addicted to diet pills for about 5 years.
Was it because of the speed or because of your urge to be thin?
Well, it started out as an urge to be thin. We all give ourselves an excuse. And it was a valid excuse for about a month. But really, I had found my drug. I mean, for about a month until I lost weight. And then it was just, I had found my drug. I didn't get addicted. You know, I did a lot of drugs in the early 70s. But I didn't get addicted to anything else. That was my addiction.
You changed your name to Patty Davis as opposed mm-hmm. to Patty Reagan, taking mm-hmm. your mother's maiden name, so that you wouldn't always be seen as daughter of.
Yeah.
Did it accomplish what you wanted to? I mean, now people are knowing you more and more as daughter of,
right.
'Cause that's what you've been writing about.
Right, right. Well, I think symbolically, I was 20-something, 22 or something when I changed it. I think symbolically I wanted my own name. But I see now that taking my mother's maiden name was really that little child in me saying, is this okay? Do you like me now?
Patty Davis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patty Davis' memoir is called The Way I See It. She spoke with Terry Gross. I'm Marty Moskowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. The worst violence appears to be over in South Central Los Angeles. Residents are starting to clean up and address the sense of injustice that sparked the riots. Sweet Alice Harris has been through this before. She started a group of concerned residents in the aftermath of the Watts riots in 1965. Today, she's at work to help put South Central back together again. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to Sweet Alice Harris. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a recent box set of vintage recordings by the blues singer Howlin' Wolf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Los Angeles, Mayor Tom Bradley has lifted a nighttime curfew that had been in place since rioting occurred last week. However, at the same time, Bradley said that there are no immediate plans to pull out more than 10,000 National Guard and Army troops sent in to help stop the violence. Schools also opened again this morning, but under very tight security. While the Sheriff's Department puts property damage in the city at more than $717 million, private insurers say that damages may go as high as $1 billion. Last night, a motorist was shot to death after National Guardsmen said he attempted to crash his car into a group of soldiers. So far, some 11,000 people have been arrested on riot-related charges. Against the backdrop of President Bush's promise of $600 million in aid to Los Angeles, Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton toured damaged areas of that city today. NPR's John McChesney reports.
Governor Clinton visited Koreatown this morning. Koreatown was one of the most heavily damaged areas in the city and is a focus of attention because of the anger between Korean immigrants and the city's black community. This afternoon, Clinton met with several community groups and outlined some of his proposals to help inner-city areas. Clinton seemed to be cautiously searching for the middle ground between suburban voters and traditional Democratic supporters from minority groups. To that end, he appealed to suburban voters by saying that the consequences of poverty are simply too expensive for all taxpayers.
Sooner or later, we all pay. We are all in this together. We go up or down together. When you have too many people on welfare or in the criminal system, then they're not working. They're drawing tax dollars instead of paying taxes into the government. And it all serves to weaken this economy.
In Los Angeles, I'm John McChesney reporting.
In Germany, there were major disruptions in air travel today as labor strikes spread to airport personnel. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
At airports in Berlin, Dusseldorf, Hamburg, and Cologne, numerous flights were canceled or rerouted to smaller airports. Tomorrow, strikes are also scheduled for the country's largest airport in Frankfurt. A week-long strike by civil servants in Germany has paralyzed the public transportation system throughout the country, causing daily traffic jams at rush hour. Mail services have come to a standstill, and uncollected garbage is attracting flies and rats in many cities. Government officials today agreed to resume wage negotiations with striking unions on Wednesday, hinting they will offer to improve their wage offer for civil servants at the lower end of the pay scale. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials gained over 41 points to close at 3,378.13, a record. This is NPR News. In New York City, UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali says he is very disturbed by continued violence in Bosnia. His statement comes after a weekend of fighting involving various ethnic factions. Officials say after a deal had been worked out to free the Bosnian president in exchange for the release of a local Federal Army commander and his troops, local forces ambushed an army convoy. After a Belgian officer was killed, a team from the European Community suspended its peacekeeping efforts. In Washington, House officials have delivered all records of the now-closed House Bank to a Justice Department special counsel. This action came after a federal court judge refused to void subpoenas for all House banking records, including the records of 170 House members who wrote no bad checks. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Last week, a handful of House members went to court to challenge the subpoenas issued by the Justice Department special counsel. They did so even before the House of Representatives voted to comply with the subpoenas and turn over all the House records. As Congressman Henry Gonzalez put it in a letter to Speaker Tom Foley last week before the vote, "You cannot waive my rights no matter what you do." But today, federal Judge John Garrett Penn rejected the challenge brought by Gonzalez and four other House members, all of whom had either no overdraft checks or a very small number. Penn noted in his decision that the Justice Department special counsel, Malcolm Wilkie, had promised to return unreviewed copies of checks written by the 170 House members with no overdrafts, and the judge also noted that Wilkie has promised to maintain the confidentiality of the records. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Officials of Macy & Company have announced that up to 10 stores will be closed over the next year. The company has been operating under bankruptcy protection. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In South Central Los Angeles today, some people have phones and electricity, others do not. Some food has been donated, but lines to receive it are long. My guest, Sweet Alice Harris, lives in Watts, one of the neighborhoods in South Central affected by last week's uprising and the site of L.A.'s previous riots in 1965. She is founder and director of Parents of Watts, working with youth and adults. Harris is 57 years old, the mother of 9 children and 13 grandchildren. Like many people who live in her neighborhood, last week's rebellion was no surprise to her. For 27 years, she's been listening to young people who feel that they're outside of the system. We called her at her office in Watts to find out what things are like there today. But first, I wanted to know why she started her first community group back in 1965.
Well, I started it in my home, in the housing project, during the time that we had a riot. I knew something was going to happen. And I knew it was going to be drastic. I just didn't know it was going to be as drastic as it was. And then and the next morning, seeing the blood run down the drain and seeing that we didn't have no place for medical facilities. We didn't have anything. The women was having babies in the home and take so long to get an ambulance to come out. I just thought to myself, something has to be done. We're going to have to organize ourselves and to get our community back together.
What kind of damage in your neighborhood from the riots over the last weekend?
We have to go now to go with the closest gas place was Manhattan Beach. Now that's a long ways.
So you're
in other words, to go get some grocery now, if I had to get a cab, and I'm just saying this for your view in your head, because no cab come in here. We don't have cab services in here, and the bus services stops at when it first get dark.
So you never had bus service.
We never had bus service
in your neighborhood after dark.
We don't have cab service. Period. And the light rail. I think it was. We just got the blue line, but I think it cut off around 8 o'clock.
So
we don't have transportation here anyway. But if I had to go now to get some bread, and I call a cab, it would cost me about $30 for them to take me there and back.
As you look out your window, then, what do you see? How has your neighborhood changed?
It's depressed, more or less. People are standing out, you know, more or less wondering. I see the ones that had jobs. Their children didn't even go to school, so I know that, and they could have went to school today, so I know they are at a loss.
When did you go outside? When did you begin to?
I was outside when this was happening.
Were you talking to people?
Yes, we was trying. Well, actually, we knew this was going to happen. We'd sit here for about 3 hours, praying and hoping that they wouldn't come back with that kind of a statement, that it wouldn't be, find them not guilty. We was getting phone calls. It looked like the air had quit blowing. Everybody was glued to a television. You couldn't talk without them saying, "Be quiet." Wherever you went, "Hush, hush, hush," on the street, "Have the verdict come back yet? what was the verdict. And the minute the verdict come out, you walked outside. I walked outside, and I heard people screaming and hollering. Screaming, hollering, and cursing.
Sweet Alice Harris is founder and executive director of Parents of Watts, working with youth and adults. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Sweet Alice Harris is my guest. When the fires and the looting and the violence occurred at the end of last week, did you feel like it was 1965 all over again?
Well, I didn't feel like it was 1965 all over again. I sort of felt like they didn't listen. They didn't listen to us, so I didn't feel whether it was 1965. I just felt hurt because they didn't listen, and they have allowed this thing to come to this head. I know how hard it's been trying to get us this far, and I know we have set it's a setback. But had they listened to us, I even wrote a letter to President Bush's wife about 3 months ago, asking if she would come down and if I could have a meeting with her. I said, I'll even come there. And they wrote me a letter and said her schedule was too busy. I put a letter in to Hillary Clinton 2 weeks ago and wanted to go there and talk to somebody because I knew this was going to happen. And I knew once it happened, then the community would be at a setback. But, hey, what you going to do when people won't listen to you?
What would you have said if you'd either spoken with Hillary Clinton or Barbara Bush?
I wanted them to come out and hear the community, and I felt like once they heard the grassroots, they heard the people that's hurting, they could give them some comfort word, because I knew that that verdict had to come in, and I knew that we was keeping the young people quiet, waiting on the verdict. We were saying you will get justice. You will get justice, though, because we could have had a ride when Mike Tyson was put in jail versus Willie Smith. You know, all of this is comparison. Everything that happened, it was a comparison where one was free and the black was gave time to. But I wanted them to come out and help us say it is some justice. You know, there will be justice. If we don't get it now, we will eventually get it, but they needed to hear some new voices.
I'm wondering, this is just looking at or from things I read in the paper and stories I saw on television, how much the looting and the fires had to do with justice and how much of it had to do with people taking advantage of a chaotic situation.
Now, what I'm saying is, I didn't say the burning and tearing up was right. I'm not saying that's right. But what I'm trying to say is it was wrong for the leaders to make the people down here so angry till they was willing to tear up and burn up to be heard.
How do you suggest that the people of South Central Los Angeles or even the community leaders, the mayor and others, how do you suggest that they attract businesses back to the neighborhood? And is that part of the solution?
You see, every young man can be trained to build. Young ladies can be trained to build. When the freeway came through and they told us they was going to hire people from the community, they fixing up the housing project. They said they going to hire people from the community. But you know the way they got out of it? They're not trained. We can't hire them if they're not trained. We've heard companies that tell us we're in business to make money. And we can't hire them if they're not trained. But if you send me some trained, will harm. They knew that before they got the contract. So what we need is apprenticeship. If they're going to build it up, let the people here build it up. Let the young folks build it up. Don't send no more million-dollar companies in here to build it up. Because by the time they get it built up, it'll be another 20 years. And you'll be building it up again.
What kind of a summer are you anticipating? And
hot summer.
I was going to say it's going to get hotter. Kids are going to be out of school.
Well, they're going to turn the fire hydrant on. Because, see, when you don't have anything, you know, nothing from nothing leaves nothing. They were going to have to swim in the gutter anyway. Because they don't have nowhere else to swim. This every summer is a long, hot summer. Because they don't have no recreations. They don't have no swimming pools here. So it wasn't going to make no difference for that part. The part that's going to make a difference is the people that was working in the stores that was burnt down. Now that's added on to what was already. And bad, that's added on to. Because they could take their children out of the community to recreation centers and to swimming pools. Now they won't be able to take their children. Now their children got to swim in the gutters.
Do you think anything good is going to come out of this situation?
If it get the top leaders to listen, if it get them to listen and help the surviving people, then we don't mind suffering. Because I've done all this living for the day that the leaders will listen and make a difference for the young people. You see, I'm old. I don't have another 25 years. I'll be going on home. But somebody will be here. And young people are going to be here as long as the world, the earth is here, because they're being born every day. They need a chance. They need to feel like they belong in America. Now, if you can't feel like you belong here, then maybe we need to talk about going somewhere else. But somewhere down the line, we got to belong. We got to feel like we part of America.
Sweet Alice Harris is founder and executive director of Parents of Watts, working with youth and adults. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. Robert Siegel, my colleague, has spent the weekend talking with folks in Los Angeles, and he has a report about their hopes for rebuilding. Wendy Kaufman reports on the Los Angeles Police. The question, should Chief Daryl Gates have deployed his forces faster? There's been a great deal of criticism of the police, especially about the first 2 days of the troubles there. I'll talk with the author of a book about the Watts rioting in 1965. He says that was about black power. Black power has arrived. Now, the problem today is that the entire underclass is growing larger. Also, John Burnett reports from Texas on the campaign of Ross Perot.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. Along with Muddy Waters and Willie Dixon, Howlin' Wolf was one of the big three of Chicago blues in the 1950s. All were originally from the Delta region of western Mississippi. All of them recorded for Chess Records, and all were formidable talents. Kevin has a review of a recent box set of vintage recordings by Howlin' Wolf.
And Kevin says Wolf had one thing that gave him an advantage over the competition.
They called me the Howling Wolf, Mama. And you found me howling at your door. They called me the Howling Wolf, baby. And you know you found me howling at your door.
Chester Burnett, better known as Howlin' Wolf, had one of the most extraordinary instruments in American music, a voice you could sand floors with. Even after he'd left Mississippi for Chicago, he never lost the raw, rough sound of a Delta blues man. In his music, you could hear the rasp of dust caught in a sharecropper's throat and the pounding rhythm of railroad men driving spikes. Actually, Howlin' Wolf's music reaches back beyond work songs, beyond 19th century field hollers, all the way back to Africa. It's amazing how many African retentions have been carried forward through the oral traditions of black Americans to surface in the work of artists who'd heard little, if any, African music. World music, of course, didn't used to be a big trend like it is nowadays. On Wolf's 1956 record, The Natchez Burnin', the delicate web of sound woven by piano and acoustic guitars sounds oddly like a kora, the West African harp. These echoes are doubtless unintentional, but they're there anyway.
Shall I join with them? New eyes with them. Rosie Mae was there. Did you ever hear about the burning that happened way down in Natchez, Mississippi town? I stood back, was looking in the old building done tumbled down.
I don't want to give you the impression Howlin' Wolf was just a backward-looking musician. In his great Chess recordings from the 1950s, you also get a sense of the shock of adjusting to urban life after a rural upbringing. Like a few other great Chicago bluesmen, he catches the harshness and alienation of big city life without forsaking his country roots. The train song Smokestack Lightning was a hit for Wolf in 1956. Like his Chess label mate and rival, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf was around long enough to span great changes in American music, from rural blues to the psychedelic era. Like Muddy, he eventually recorded with some of the British rockers he'd helped inspire, with uneven results. In fact, Wolf's career illustrates a basic truth about the music industry. Just because you're a great artist doesn't mean your label won't make you record dumb songs in a quest for hits.
Ooh-wee, what a baby. Ooh-wee, what a baby. When I hold her in my arm, brings out all of her hidden charm. Get it.
Somehow, Howlin' Wolf maintained his dignity and integrity even on flyweight tunes like that one. The ability to transcend inferior material is what identifies any great artist working in a commercial medium like pop music. The blues may be an art form, but Chess was in the business of selling records. Much as I like to complain about record companies, I have no major beefs about the 3-CD boxed set of Howlin' Wolf recordings MCA issued a few months ago. That's where all this music comes from. It's not perfect, but you get 6 dozen tunes, and a little bit of Wolf talking, and a couple of good essays, and some nice pictures. That's enough.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. And here's Howlin' Wolf with Moanin' for My Baby. This week are Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Audrey Viblitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bob Simon is the CBS News reporter who was taken prisoner during the Gulf War and held for 6 weeks. He's written a book about his 40 days in captivity. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Bob Simon. I'm Marty Moss Cowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.